Hey, fans, and welcome to the Big Blue Box Podcast. My name's Gary.
My name's Adam.
And it's episode 373.
Yeah, it is.
Hey, Who fans, welcome back to another episode. Hope you're keeping safe and well. We hope you've had a cracking week and that you've all managed to do something
Doctor Who
related. beat you again.
Yeah, so you did
indeed. Welcome to another episode. If this is the first time that you are tuning in to the Big Blue Box, then welcome aboard. It's good to have you here. If you're a long time listener, one of the grizzled ancients, and it's good to have you here as well. Welcome one and all. It's been a quiet week on the old news, bud. Not much cracking on. But before we mention what we've been up to in the world of Doctor Who, if anything, how's your week been, bud? You've been good?
Yes. Yeah, not too bad. Yeah, I did a little something Who related this week, which I'm surprised about, because obviously we're reviewing Invasion of the Dinosaurs this week, and that is a mammoth six-parter following on from our last mammoth six-parter of the Seeds of Doom last week. So, you know, there's not been a lot of spare time the last couple of weeks, but I was really in the mood to watch a documentary that I remembered loving and hadn't watched for ages. It was called 30 Years in the TARDIS, and it was released on DVD back in the day alongside Sharda. So it was like a double DVD set called the Legacy Collection, I think. And I don't know what put it in my mind or why I was thinking about it, and I thought, yes, going to settle down and watch that tonight. It was as good, if not better, than I remember. Have you seen it?
Oh, cool. Yeah, I have. Yeah, it's great, though.
It is absolutely brilliant. The amount of effort that's gone into it. So they've managed to get so many actors from, like, the 30 years Doctor Who, because a lot of them were still alive then. So Verity Lambert's on there, which is lovely to see chatting. And it's just such a fun documentary. And it's not just all sort of facts and figures. They put all these fun little scenes in, like... there's a bit where the brig, so obviously Nicholas Courtney's talking to camera as Nicholas Courtney, but then he sort of goes into character as the brig and gets in a car and it's driven by an Auton, and John Pert was outside the National Theatre in London in the Whomobile talking about dinosaurs and being followed around it by an Ogron, and it's bizarre, but it's amazing the amount of effort that's gone into it. And there's a bit at the end where this little kid who's sort of going through the story, if you like, of the documentary while they're showing all these wonderful outtakes and clips of Doctor Who over the years. I'd forgotten how many sort of behind-the-scenes clips they showed, which, when this came out, was a real treat because, you know, although we've got a lot of that stuff now on Blu-ray, they've sort of, you know, to have it all in this sort of hour-long, whatever it is, 90-minute documentary, it's just so cool. There's a bit at the end where the kid goes into the TARDIS on the embankment and he opens the door.
Oh, yeah.
And actually, I think it's the first time, really, when they show someone going into the TARDIS box, or it was then, obviously not now, and into the actual console room. And for the time and for a documentary that was just made very cheaply, it's beautifully done. And Carol Ann Ford's waiting in the TARDIS for him and stuff. And there's this lovely piece of music, which is very 90s, I guess. Or is it 80s? No, it would be 90s, I think. And it's just so beautiful. It's such a lovely scene. It's just, I can't believe the amount of effort in that documentary. And I put a little picture on Twitter and it really blew up. People were like saying, because I wasn't sure how many people had watched it, you know, I was like, is this a little niche documentary that's kind of got forgotten about over time? And it got so much love, that tweet. And it really made me pleased. I was like, I'm so glad so many people have watched this, because it's absolutely brilliant. Yeah, and if anyone sort of got that set and that's been sat there gathering dust and they thought, oh yeah, I've never watched the documentary disc or the second disc, get it on. It's absolutely brilliant. It's so funny in places as well. It's absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, I like those little mini episodes that they that they show in between the interviews and stuff. Some of those are really cool, plus really funny. You know, like in like Susan and the Daleks, and you know those little bit. You know, just really cool little bits like that. Yeah, that's very cool. That documentary.
It's got a bizarre ending, though, isn't it? So there's a bit with Elizabeth Sladen where she's sort of she's walking with her daughter through a, I don't know, big stately home or something, and they meet a Sontaran at the top of the stairs. And then later on, Liz Sladen comes and sits down on the sofa with the kid that's been in throughout the whole DVD. And then right at the end, she sort of grabs his neck and her eyes light up. And it's like, and that's how it ends. It's like, what's going on? It's got a really sort of bizarre ending to it. This probably sounds bonkers, listeners. If you don't know what we're talking about, if you're thinking, what is this documentary? It's just a celebration of 30years.2. They show lots of clips. They go into lots of behind-the-scenes detail. They give you lots of fun little facts and figures. But they've also filmed all these funny little sort of segments that make up a mini story. And the other best bit about it is they sort of break it down into mini episodes. And, excuse me, in between the episodes, they've inserted old Doctor Who commercials that I'm amazed they've still got. So there's like a Second Doctor one where he's around a console, and what's the other ones they've got in there? The Tom Baker Prime Computer adverts are in there as well. So they sort of intersperse them in between episodes as if it's a real advert break. And
they've also got they've got some Blue Peter clips. If I remember correctly, there's Crackerjack in there. There's
Crackerjack,
what's the other one? Good Morning with Anne and Nick. Remember that from the early...
Oh, where Pertwee corrects them.
Some great stuff on there.
It is just a treasure trove collection of brilliant moments, not just from Doctor Who, but anything to do with it, from like Gary just said, chat shows to adverts that were made. It's brilliant. I could watch it over and over again. It's so good.
It's great,
So I managed to get that in. But that has been, apart from that and watching 6 episodes of Invasion of Dinosaurs, that's pretty much been it. But what about you, mate? You been up to anything?
I haven't, dude. No, I've watched, obviously, all 6 parts of Invasion. We'll leave it there. If I want to be true to form, true to episode 1. But nothing else. But I've had a busy week with work, so I've not had a chance to...
A busy, busy bee.
Yeah, not had a chance to... commandeer the TV for a couple of hours and watch any Solid Who or anything. So yeah, quiet one for me, mate. Just the old review ep. Yeah,
I finished watching it last night very late because I got in late from a disastrous trip into town, and it finished about 12:30. I finished it. And I thought, right, I must go to bed, but I really wanted to watch an extra feature on the disc, which was the Now and Then. So because it's got so many locations in it. There's a Now and Then, excuse me, featurette showing all the locations, what they look like now. And you know, I love my locations. I was like, I have got to just quickly watch that before I go to bed. So it's about 1 o'clock by the time I actually finished it off and went to bed. But it was worth it. Such a great little Now and Then featurette. I love it when you see how the locations have changed and all that. Because there's quite a lot in this story, isn't there?
There is, mate.
It's a lot of locations.
Lots going on. Yeah.
But we'll get to that in the story, but yes, I had to watch that before I went to bed last night.
We will get to that, yes. Before we crack on with our review, etc., just a quick bit of news that should be announced by the time you guys are listening to this. If you're listening on launch day, which will be Friday the 27th, we should have the next Blu-ray box set announced, right, dude? Which is quite exciting.
It's looking like it. Yeah, it's been rumoured. It sort of started circulating a couple of weeks ago when I think it was listed on some foreign website that season 9 was going to be the next Blu-ray set, that, you know, the Pertwee season. And that seems to have gathered a bit of momentum. And then today, a link went live on Amazon. Now, at the time of recording this, we aren't 100% this is true. It could all be a big fake, but it's looking like it's true. And I would imagine by the time this podcast goes out, it will have been officially announced, because my Twitter timeline is already full of lots of different pictures of the set, including all the stuff inside it and the discs and all the artwork. So we're pretty confident this is real and not a fake thing. What I'm thinking is, by the time the BBC announced this, like 3 o'clock or whatever this afternoon, people are going to be like, whatever. You know, the time, it will just get lost, won't it? They'll put out this big picture you know, tweet with all the pictures on. Like, it's out, then we'll be like, yeah, we know.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, it's been circulating for weeks. I mean, I don't know. I know they have to, like, do it properly and they've got it all scheduled and stuff. But, yeah, I think their tweet's going to get a bit lost because my timeline's already filled with all the pictures of the set. So, and I already, I'm not going to say it in case it's not true, but I've already been told the release date and when the next BFI is and stuff. It's like, I don't know how this stuff gets out there, but I kind of already know it all, I think. Unless it's all some big sham.
It's a ruse.
It's a ruse, yeah.
Throw you off the scent, yeah.
Wouldn't it be amazing if actually they'd put an announcement out at 3 o'clock and it's like, actually, it's season 26 or 20, no, 25, 26 already, isn't it? Or something else. And we're all like, oh my God, BBC. We're so sorry, you tricked us. But yeah, it won't be. It'll be season 9.
It will be season 9. We know that.
We think, yeah. Or either that or we're going to look very smug and stupid on Friday, but we're fairly confident on this one, aren't we?
Pretty much, yeah. So this is your usual warning when any of these box sets get released. You need to pre-order it, because if you don't, they'll sell out and then you'll be crying into your Doctor Who TARDIS cereal bowl in your cornflakes. Yeah. Especially on launch day when everyone starts filling up Insta and the socials with all the pics of their new box set and you're like, oh God, I really want that now. So, as usual, if you want it, you're going to have to pre-order it. Them's the breaks.
I was going to ask you what you think of the artwork, but I think we should probably leave that till next week till we've got it officially announced and we know that the artwork is real, I guess.
Yes, let's save that conversation. Let's save that for next week. Yeah.
Okay.
Right, dude, before we crack on with our review, make sure, dear listener, that you are following and subscribing to this podcast in your preferred podcast app of choice, wherever you get your podcasts. We're on all the networks, all the apps, etc. That way you won't miss an episode when it lands every single Friday. You can also listen for free over on the website, which is bigblueboxpodcast.co.uk, and you can read and check out all of the great reviews and articles from our awesome writing team. Go and check that out. We're on the socials too. Instagram, Twitter and Facebook. There are links on the website, or do a search for us. We chat Doctor Who throughout the week, so come and get involved over there. And we have a very cool free Discord server. Again, link is on the website. Hop in there and chat Doctor Who with lots of other cool Who fans. And don't forget to remember to go and check out Adam's channel over on his YouTube. It is, of course, The Geek's Handbag.
The Geek's Handbag. Plenty of videos on there for you to go and watch. And I'm working on a cracking new vlog at the minute.
Cracking.
A B&M vlog is on the way. And yeah, I know certain viewers like those. So, yes, that'll be coming. Soonish.
Indeed.
It's those ones are always mammoth videos, so it takes a while to get them together. But yes, go and check out my channel. Also on the socials, Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, the Twitterverse, which is still alive. Twitter still lives.
Indeed, it does.
It's been written off a couple of weeks ago, hadn't it? But it's still going.
It's still going. Actually, on the topic of that conversation, we are on a Mastodon as well. So if you're thinking of ditching Twitter, or you just want to have a look over there. So Mastodon is like another social network that's blown up loads over the last month or two since all the crap Twitter stuff's happened. So the Big Blue Box is over on Mastodon. There's a link on the website, or just do a search for us on Mastodon and you can follow us over there too. Right, buddy. Review time. What are we doing?
Yes, so some Pertwee action this week with a mammoth six-parter called Invasion of the Dinosaurs.
A variety of prehistoric reptiles began to appear in the central London area.
For a moment there, time went backwards.
I've been here on this spaceship for 3 months.
Somebody inside this organization is working against us.
Operation Golden Age.
This world of ours swept clean and returned to its early innocence.
To the Doctor. Well, he made the monsters.
I'm instituting a full-scale search for the Doctor at once. They are to shoot on sight.
Kind, decent people who just might object to the destruction of generations of human beings.
You can't be allowed to go about saying these things. You'll have to be re-educated.
Even the BBC had to cut short the roaring T-Rex in the trailer. Just lop it off. Yes.
Yeah.
Alrighty, Invasion of the Dinosaurs. It was first broadcast, so episode one, that started to go out on the 12th of January, 1974, and then the sixth part finished up on the 16th of February. It was written by Malcolm Hulk, directed by Paddy Russell, overseen by Terence Dix, Robert Holmes, uncredited for old Mr. Holmes, and produced by Barry Letts. So the dream team, some would say, of some of the classic Who stuff. Stars, obviously, John Pertwee as the Third Doctor, with Elizabeth Sladen as Sarah Jane, and then a fairly decent-sized supporting cast for this one, mostly the UNIT guys, so Nicholas Courtney, Richard Franklin as Captain Yates, John Levine as Sergeant Benson, all those guys, and then a few other people. The synopsis is the Third Doctor and Sarah arrive in 1970s London to find it has been evacuated because dinosaurs have appeared mysteriously. As the line between friends and enemies wavers, the Doctor soon discovers the dinosaurs are being brought to London via a time machine to further a plan to revert Earth back to a pre-technological, quote-unquote, golden age. So, what are your thoughts on Invasion of the Dinosaurs, dude?
My thoughts on Invasion of the Dinosaurs are that I remember liking it, but watching it again this week, I enjoyed it even more than I thought. It was actually a lot better than I remembered. So although I've always thought it was quite a fun story, being a six-parter, I was thinking, yeah, it'll have that usual six-parter lag feel. It's going to feel drawn out and could have been a four-parter and all that sort of stuff, which is kind of true. I think by the time we get to episode five, it does get a bit repetitive and the chase sequence is clearly padding in episode five, and then it has a nice wrap up in the last episode. But overall, I was really entertained by this story, mate, through the whole six episodes. I didn't get bored at all. It might be because I split it up. So I watched it two episodes at a time. So two Monday, two Tuesday, two Wednesday. Finished it up nicely last night, and yeah, I really, really enjoyed it. As I said, I expected to enjoy it, but not as much as I did. I thought there was a lot more humour in it than I remember. I love the way the cast are just bouncing off each other in every single scene. You know, there's just so many lovely moments in it, like when the Doctor's desperate to get some peace and he locks the door, and then the Brigadier walks in the other door, and just moments like that just really put a big smile on my face. And you know, just addressing the dinosaur in the room, I think they, to me, are really the only thing that lets this down. I think it's a great story. It's got an interesting concept. The idea of the people on the spaceship coming into it midway through really helps to keep the story interesting. And my only real faults of it are the dinosaurs themselves, which I think most people will acknowledge look absolutely terrible, even for the time this was made, and it being Doctor Who on a shoestring budget, they still look awful. But it's it doesn't ruin my enjoyment. I don't sit there and think, oh, you know, this is terrible, I'm going to have to switch this off. I still find it very entertaining, and I think the cast really sell it. You know, I mean, you've got this ridiculous looking dinosaur, And yet John Pertwee still manages to look terrified and do all the action stuff. And yeah, I thought it was great, mate. And I mentioned the locations earlier. I love the fact so much of this is on location. I love seeing Pertwee blitzing around all these gas works and Kingston, wherever it was filmed, and helicopters flying over. And it feels epic. And the Whomobile racing around, you know, London as well. It's got a lot going on. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. The whole six parts, I really, really enjoyed it. It's really gone up in my estimation, in my list of Pertwee stories. I thought it was great. Even with the terrible dinosaurs, I thought it was a great, fun story. What about you?
The Whomobile.
The Whomobile.
Jesus Christ, eh?
You just know that Pertwee just loved getting in that thing.
Yeah.
He just loved it, didn't he?
It's a cool little car. And you can tell that Pertwee just took one look at it and thought, oh, that looks futuristic. And
I must have it.
Very cool. We have that in the show. And everyone's like, no, we can't. And he's like, well, we're having it. And that's it, because I've bought it. So
who would win out of Bessie and the Whomobile in the race? If I was in the Whomobile and you were in Bessie, clearly your favourite of the two, who would win?
I think the Whomobile would get the hop on Bessie in terms of pulling away from the start line.
Yeah.
But I think if it was a quite a long race, we're talking about 10 miles, I reckon Bessie would just happily plod along and outwit the Whomobile. Yeah.
Imagine you foot to the pedal, driving Bessie and me and you racing. And I'm in the Hoomobile, I'm inching next to you, I'm getting there, and you think, and you're just starting to overtake me. And then all of a sudden you think, where's the Hoomobile gone? And you look up, and of course, I've switched into flight mode, and I'm actually flying over you, laughing manically like the master. Flying over Bessie, but yeah, maybe you still beat me, we don't know.
Who knows?
Yeah. We've got to make that happen. We must get one.
We must get a Hoomobile and a Bessie from somewhere. I'm sure there's some private collectors who wouldn't mind being...
I'm sure the exhibitions have left the door open. We can just sneak in and nick it.
Right, what were we saying? Invasion of Dinosaurs, thoughts, right. I think this one's pretty cool. But I wouldn't say it's... I wouldn't say it's up there with any of my fave Pertwee stories.
Okay.
But I do think it's kind of cool. I wouldn't say it's like... I don't come away after watching it thinking that's just quintessentially amazing Pertwee Who. I come away thinking, okay, that was a pretty good story.
That's a pretty good one.
So it's not setting the world on fire for me, but it's still a decent watch. And I think a lot of times when we talk about these long parts in Classic Who, like the six-parters and all that stuff, and we often say, don't we, that there's a bit of padding there and could it have been a four-parter and all that lot. I genuinely think that this could have been a four-parter quite comfortably.
Yeah.
Because in episode five, is it? I think it's episode four or five. In one of those episodes, there's just lots of the Doctor escaping UNIT. So UNIT are chasing after him, and they've got the helicopter out, and they're in the military vans and everything, and they're driving through the countryside, and it takes ages for you to realise that they're not going to catch him. And then there is a kind of there's a cool little thing when he's hopped in one of the UNIT trucks, and they're on the radio, and he's like, "Oh, don't worry, we've got him," you know, coming back. So he's kind of cancels the search on him because, you know, they think they've captured him, and he drives off. But to get to that point, it's like 15 minutes worth of, you know, just driving around and hiding, a bit more driving. So I know that's difficult to make anything of substance of that, especially when you spent all this money to go out on location and you've got military trucks and you've hired the helicopter and you've got the Hoomobile rocking and rolling and and all that. So I get it. You need to get your investment. You need to get return on your investment. And in this case, the return is screen time. So I get that. But yeah, it's like in parts four and five. Part five wasn't too bad. It was just a lot of stuff going on that doesn't really equal much. The only thing that we get in that part is the Doctor twigs, doesn't he, that Yates is the mole within UNIT,
and traitor.
and then he allows the very loyal Benton, you know. Benton allows him to do his little death grip
thingy,
his faint grip, and then he can escape and, you know, all that stuff. And then it's really part six is where it picks back up again and we kick back into some decent stuff. So the story overall, the first few episodes are very cool. It really does pad out a bit for those two. And then part six, you're back in the game and you're rocking and rolling. So, yeah. Should we get the elephant or the dinosaur in the room out the way early before we move on? Because I know listeners probably thinking, tell us what you thought of the amazing puppetry work. So a bit of background on this, right? Mm-hmm. Barry Letts absolutely loved the Drashigs and the visual effects and how they achieved that and the fluidity with the puppets and all that stuff. And the Drashigs had been built by back in the day, it was the official BBC visual effects department. They had done that, but they had said, we just don't have the resources to do this. So it's just not going to work. So what we suggest you do is you go to outsource it, basically go to a third party company. They'll be able to do it for you. So they approached a guy called Cliff Cully, who ran a visual effects company. And they had worked on Planet of the Daleks. So they had some experience with working at the BBC or with the BBC on Doctor Who already. However, he found that when they were partway through building them, that he didn't have the capacity to finish the job either. And so he subcontracted the work to a guy called Rodney Fuller. And Rodney Fuller finished the job and all the rest of it. Long story short, when it comes to actually putting these things in front of the camera, Barry Letts is like, oh my God, this is a disaster.
Imagine his face.
This is an absolute disaster. And the reason why is because the dinosaurs themselves were just very, very static, very, very difficult to maneuver. Just very, it's like some kids had built some model dinosaurs in school, and that was it. But because the dinosaurs themselves were obviously a big part of the story, they had to do something with them. So the guy that they subcontracted, Rodney Fuller, as a result of this, his company went out of business fairly soon afterwards because of the disaster that people saw on screen. And so it was left to Paddy Russell to try and do something with them on screen. So you can see the struggles that they went through to try and get these things to look half decent on screen. So I thought it was important to provide a bit of context, that a context rather than just say, yep, they look crap. And yeah, let's face it, they do look very, very basic and quite awful in some shots. But to understand why they didn't quite live up to expectations, it was a disaster from start to finish. But there we go. So what do you think to the dinosaur models in this then? Because there was one scene where they didn't look too bad. It was a scene where Sarah Jane's trapped in with the T-Rex. And it starts to wake up, and this is part of the sabotage story, right, where the chains that were holding it had been cut, and Sarah Jane's trapped in there. There was a scene where they sort of darkened it out a little bit, and they'd put some Vaseline or something over its mouth and its eyes, and the way it was moving and stuff actually looked pretty cool. The other scenes, it's just it's difficult to immerse yourself in that, because like at the beginning, there's a bit where there's two unit guys in a truck and they're standing in front of some blue screen, obviously, and they're just sort of aiming their guns roughly up at the ceiling, and they're shooting away. But the problem is the dinosaurs, because they can't move anywhere, they're immobile, essentially. They're just standing on the spot and its head's moving very slowly. So you've got the people on the ground who are supposedly going nuts, but the dinosaurs are not moving. They're just stationary and they're just wobbling around a little bit. So it's difficult then to justify the panic that they're trying to make it, because they've evacuated central London. That's part of the story. So you've got the doctor and the brig and the other unit guys who are sort of, so the story is trying to make you feel like these dinosaurs are a massive threat before they disappear. But really, the guys on the ground, they're just sort of standing around having a chat. You know, the doctor's trying to do his thing. Anyway, what did you think to these models? Because, we are talking very basic in this one.
Yeah, I mean, even by Doctor Who standards, back in the day when this was made, they look pretty poor. They're just so rubbery and there's no detail to them. And I mean, I know you're not a fan of the Drashigs, really. I know you don't like them, but I think even they look incredible compared to these.
They do, actually.
I mean, the fight sequence at the end where the T-Rex and the, what is it? Is it Diplodocus or something? I don't know. The two dinosaurs at the end that are having a good old fight. It's grabbing its neck. I think they needed to trim that a little in the edit, because it just looks so bad. And there's a bit where it flicks its tail at it as if it's angry. It cracks me up. They definitely do let the story down. And I would imagine even back in the day, you would think, oh dear. I mean, that's the thing I often say with Doctor Who, that although we look at the effects now, back in the day, you know, children would have been probably quite amazed in a magical way by some of the effects that Doctor Who had, because it just was so innovative, you know, even though it didn't always pay off. But I think even back in the day, people would have been watching this going, what on earth, you know? And it's such a shame, because I think, as I said, the cast are all playing it for real, and thank goodness they are, because I think that really helps to make the story more interesting and believable. But yeah, it's so let down when you get a shot of like Pertwee looking so cool and in action mode, and then it cuts to one of the dinosaurs that looks so terrible. It definitely definitely lets it down, the whole story. The bit where they drive under it and stuff, I mean, it just makes it comical. It would be one of those things that people would use if they were going to say why Doctor Who was classic Doctor Who's bad, they would use this as an example, like the effects, you know, look at this. Because they're bad. There's just no way around it. You know, they look bad. And I think that shot you mentioned is probably the only half-decent shot of the dinosaurs. Yeah. The thing is, though, you can see a bit of effort's gone into the sets, you know, that the dinosaurs are on. So they've tried to recreate, like, the underground and the buildings almost to such fine detail. Although the lighting's bright and it clearly is a model, I can see that they've put a bit of effort into the sets, whoever did them. Maybe that was the original... makers or I don't know. But the dinosaurs look terrible. There's no getting away from it. I don't think anybody could defend how bad they look, really.
Yeah, and thank God for the director and the people making it, who have obviously just really drummed it into the actors, like, look, forget about what you're going to see eventually on screen. You just need to be terrified that there's dinosaurs in London. So... because we have a lot of classic Who episodes, don't we, where especially the supporting cast sometimes, you can see that they're just not taking it seriously enough. They're not putting themselves into it.
Yeah.
Whereas most, well, probably all of the cast members in this story are really just selling you that, you know, that dinosaurs are really, you know, a dangerous thing within London at the moment. And so if they hadn't have been like that, then this story definitely would have fallen on its arse a little bit, because it's down to the actors to sell that to you, that they're looking up at a, you know, 10-ton dinosaur in, you know, down the street. So that's the saving grace for me. So although, yes, the models look subpar compared to what they wanted to achieve in the first place, the actual performance from the actors who are imagining that there's a dinosaur in front of them makes it sort of fills in the gap, if you a little bit, if you know what I mean. It sort of plugs the hole of them looking completely ridiculous. So,
definitely. Yeah. I mean, yeah, the performances from the actors, I think, thank goodness there's a lot of location work in this, because I think that helps to make the story more visually interesting. I think if this was studio bound, it really wouldn't help with the terrible effects. I think this could quite easily get really, yeah, it would just look really shoddy. I think we didn't have the location sequences in it, which do help to make it more interesting. Yeah, but yeah, you're absolutely right. Thankfully, the cast taking it seriously. There is a nice humour to this episode as well, I think. As I said earlier, there's some great funny moments in it. Some lovely sort of comical scenes between the cast, especially the Doctor and the Brig, and also Benton and the Brig as well. I love the bit at the end where... Benton is boasting about the fact that he'd punched, the other officer, and he's so full of himself, and he turns around and the Brig's behind him, like, very unimpressed. It's like, don't make a habit of it. You know, there's lovely moments like that in this, which again, I'd sort of forgotten about, and really helped to sort of carry the story through, if you like. So
yeah, defo.
Yeah.
Okay. So in terms of story then, it's kind of, so the overarching thing, isn't there, is there's some scientist dudes via being in cahoots with a couple of people in unit and so on. So we've got the top dude, haven't we? We've got General Finch.
Finch, very shifty, very shifty looking.
Yeah.
Looking Finch, yeah.
And so for a long time, whenever we've watched a unit story, we've always assumed that the Brig is the top guy.
Yeah.
He's in command. And it's been hinted to in a previous stories and a couple of stories after this, where he doesn't mention anyone specifically. He just says his superior or, you know, whatever. So this is the first time, I think, could be wrong, on screen that we see the Brig's commanding officer, who happens to be this guy, Finch. So Finch from UNIT and also Captain Yates are in cahoots with these scientists, and they want to essentially rewind time on planet Earth, because they feel like the Earth has progressed into a not the best version of itself. Technology has taken over a little bit. The planet's polluted. So they want to rewind time, and they call it the Golden Age experiment or project, whatever. And as a result of that, they need to experiment with time travel. So they use these things called a time eddy. The Doctor calls them the time eddy. And that transports, you know, goes back to the prehistoric times, grabs a dinosaur, brings it back into modern times. That's the experiment done. They don't want to cause any harm, so they send the dinosaur back. So the point of the experiment is not to... It's not like your classic Who villain where they want to take over the Earth, so they bring dinosaurs to eat people and stuff like that. It's part of a bigger plan so that they can transport people back in time safely and then kind of just have a bit of a reset button on the Earth. And so although at first glance, especially listen, if you've not watched this story before, you might be thinking that, especially with the title of the story, that it's planet Earth versus dinosaurs. And the dinosaurs have been brought back to, you know, reclaim the Earth. It's not that. So there's kind of this human element that you can see that their intentions are good. Is good the right word? Kind of good. But they're just sort of going about it, obviously, you know, in the wrong way. So yeah, what did you think to, because I was like this, I remember years ago when I picked this up on DVD, I was thinking, oh wow, it's going to be a cool, you know, mankind versus the dinosaurs for a struggle for the planet sort of thing. And then when I watched it, I realized very quickly that it wasn't that. So what did you think to the main sort of story, I guess?
Well, I quite like it because I think it is giving us, it is bringing home a message even back then that we're destroying the planet, but without being, without, you know, doesn't have a moment where the Doctor turns to camera and gives a burbling speech. Although Pertwee does do something similar to that at the end of this episode, where he's talking to the brig saying, you know, you need to do something about the planet. And the brig's like, well, whatever. And, you know, so there is kind of a speech, but it is so much more subtle and better written than what we got in, what was the episode where Jodie's Doctor turns the camera and just preach to us. I mean, you know, so there is a message here, and but I think it's done quite well. And I always love it when we get a villain that isn't, you know, that has motive. They're not just bad guys. Their sort of intentions, if you like, are on the right side of good. You know, they're just saying, like, we've messed up the planet. We need to reset it. But so that's, you think, yeah, you're right. But then the bad side of it is that they're willing to just kill everyone apart from the elite few who they've shut away in this, you know, pretend spaceship. So yeah, their intentions on the side are good, and I like that because it makes them more interesting as, in brackets, villains, if you like, even though they're going about it the wrong way. So yeah, I like the concept, mate. I'm thinking it delivers a message subtly, but it's telling us that the planet's, you know, absolutely, I was going to use a word I can't use there, but you know, BU. That so yeah, I like it. I think it's a good concept. And I also had forgotten about the bit on the spaceship. You know, when Sarah Jane's transporting, it turns out to be a fake spaceship. I'd completely forgotten about that part of the story, and I thought that was really interesting as well, and a really fun idea. It maybe not realised brilliantly on screen. I think surely it's just the way Sarah just so casually walks out of the spaceship. Surely. I don't know. I mean, I'm not saying that any of those crew would have opened that door because they would have assumed they were going to be sucked into space. But I don't know. It feels a little bit... I don't know if the idea is realised as well as it could have been, maybe. But I do love the idea, though, that they've been tricked into thinking they're on a spaceship going towards some new Earth that is actually just going to be Earth that's been reset. I think that's a really interesting idea.
Yeah, it is. And it's... Yeah, so this pretend spaceship, if you like, that's in a bunker underneath the office where they are in London. The concept is very cool. So these people that have been chosen, they're called the Elite. They're the ones that are going to be transported back in time via the time scoop, which is a great... that was a working title for the story, actually, Time Scoop.
Time Scoop.
Yeah. And, but they've been tricked, haven't they? They think that they've been in suspended animation and they're just awaiting their arrival at, you know, this new planet.
Yeah.
And, so the idea conceptually is very cool. And that's quite a cool little subplot as well. When Sarah's on that pretend ship and she befriends that guy who he's got a bit of a good heart. So the other ones, they're a bit sort of, as the name would suggest, they're a bit elitist. You know, they don't want a non-believer amongst them, and they sort of plot to kill Sarah, don't they, if she doesn't sort of toe the line, mm-hmm. which is a bit dark. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the whole thing, it would have been cool if that took up more of the story, because that if they'd have started that bit earlier in the whole run, that could have alleviated some of the padding that we had in the other areas, potentially.
Mm. Yeah.
If that was more of a power struggle thing going on in there. But yeah, it's kind of cool.
I did laugh at the bit where the posh bloke in the suit says, I'll pop over. He said, there's a problem with the ship. It's like, I'll just dock and I'll just pop over and see you guys. Yeah. And he gets in and he's got his space suit on, but he takes it off and he's got his like posh suit on underneath. And he's like, now, what seems to be the problem? You know, so of its time, British, stiff upper lip, you know, I've just popped over to your spaceship to see what's going on here. I was just like, that's hilarious.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, there's some very proper British stuff going on in this, isn't there?
It's,
there's a scene where the doctor's back at, I think it's the temporary unit offices in London, and you can see he's making a lovely cup of tea. He's got his Tate and Lyle sugar, and he's loading his cup up, and everyone's got a cup of tea. It's like, yeah, this is so British.
Yeah, the brig even says, doesn't he, at one point, why don't you go and make a nice cup of tea, Yates, or something?
That's, do you know what? If we're having some kind of crisis, you need a cup of tea.
Yeah,
no doubt about it. Yeah. Talk about some production stuff. Episode one looks like a bag of beep, doesn't it? Because they didn't have the original recordings. So, So episode one, I remember thinking, as soon as I saw it, I'm thinking, that's got to be some sort of really old sort of recovery film or tape or something that they've had a go at colorizing. And then when I did some research before we recorded, then you can see that episode one, all they've got is the Chroma Dot recovery tape, which was obviously in black and white, so they've had a go at recoloring it, and mate, it looks ropey, doesn't it? So I'm hoping when we get around to having this story as part of one of the Blu-ray box sets, that we're going to have this in a little bit more of a cleanup operation, because episodes 2 and 6 are actually not too bad. We've still got the original PAL videotape. It's not the best, but it's not terrible by any means. It's not too bad. So, but how that episode
did they junk the other ones? Were they junked? Like, because I always imagine, I always know that like first and second Doctor episodes were junked. I always forget that a lot of Pertwee ones are also lost or destroyed. But is that the case with this? Were those episodes junked at the time? And then I think Ian Levine actually returned episode one, didn't he?
Yeah, so it was a case of the BBC had advised whoever was looking after the archives, I think, to be wiped. They sort of scheduled a whole, not just Doctor Who, they scheduled a whole bunch of shows and their original master tapes to be wiped and reused. You know, they went through that phase, didn't they, before they were properly backed up and archived. You know, they just thought, well, no one's going to want them. You know, it's just a real shame, because that's how we've lost a whole bunch of really cool stories where the BBC knowingly gave the go-ahead to just wipe them so that they could cut costs and start reusing the tapes and whatnot. But, yeah, so...
It's unbelievable, isn't it? I often forget that the Pertwee era is included in that. I always think of it as being black and white ones, and forget that there is actually, it went as far as the Pertwee era that they were destroying them. So yeah, you're right. I've just read it on Wiki. It says that they issued specific instructions to wipe all 6 episodes, but for reasons unknown, only part one was wiped. So incredible.
Yeah, and I think another version of it was handed to the Beeb in the early 80s. Somebody handed in a 16mm black and white version of the tele-recording and gave that to the Beeb. And so they used that along with this Chroma Dot recovery tape to sort of do a mix and match, like pick the best bits of each one and try and recolorize it and stuff. So, yeah, it's watchable. It's completely watchable, but you can tell that there's a night and day difference between episode one and the remaining 5 parts.
Oh, it is noticeable. I mean, it's a strange one, because I'm assuming you watched this on BritBox, did you?
I did, yes.
Yeah, and when you select it, does it automatically play the black and white version?
No, it plays the colour. Yeah.
Okay, because on the DVD, it automatically plays the black and white, and if you want to watch the colour one, you have to go into the special features to watch it, and you have to select it, and I think, oh, that's... That, I mean, that's how they just assume that it's so bad that people are going to automatically want to watch it in black and white. You know, it's that different. Rather than being sort of, you know, on the actual menu select, if you like, you have to go into special features to watch the colour one. So okay. It's it definitely does stand out as different. I mean, the thing is, it actually being in black and white does give it a slightly more eerie feel, because the bit where the pterodactyl, is it a pterodactyl? I'm not sure if I've said the right name. The thing that's attacking the doctor in the warehouse, yeah. It looks quite creepy in black and white, because when you see it in colour and it just so obviously is just a puppet on a string, you know, it doesn't quite have the same effect. So although obviously we want it in colour because it was originally shown in colour, the black and whiteness does give it a bit of an edge, I think. And I don't think it would have improved the dinosaurs a lot, but maybe they would have even looked fractionally better in black and white. I don't know. But yeah, it's a shame, though, that it's missing. I mean, you just can't believe that even during the 70s, that the people were still, BBC was still issuing tapes to be white. Thank goodness. Somebody out there, I think it was Ian Levine. I think he returned episode one. He'd got some black and white copy of it or something that is the one that you can watch now. So thank goodness people were out there trying to save them, preserve them, because it would be such a shame if the first episode was missing, because it's actually a very good episode. You know, that deserted street at the start, I think, is really eerie. And I love the bit where the TARDIS lands in the park. I don't know if you could tell in the black and white version, but they've finally given it a bit of a refurb. They've done it all up. It's been newly painted. They've replaced all the windows, so it looks all nice. And I'm thinking, you know, it's hard to believe that same prop is the same prop that fell apart on Liz Sladen in the previous episode watched season 2. Mm. But it's really funny. They've gone to all the trouble of refurbing the prop, mate, except for the light, which has still got a big smashed, it's at the top of it still smashed. I'm thinking, it's so obvious as well. It's got a piece missing out the top of it. It just amazes me when I see that. Lovely new prop with a smashed light on top of it. You know, why did they turn it round? They must have known they were shooting it from that side. Why didn't they turn the light round so you couldn't see? And maybe they couldn't. I don't know.
I don't know. Mate, I think it's just one of those little oversights that,
no one will notice that.
Yeah, like nowadays in TV and film production, there are so many people who are on set with this stuff. So, in modern day production, you have like continuity advisors, you have all these people that, and even like the set designers and those team of people, you know, they will with a fine tooth comb go through every prop and every costume and everything that you see on set. I mean, it doesn't always work out. We had the famous Starbucks coffee cup left in the background on an episode of Game of Thrones.
Yes.
You know, they don't always get it right. But back in the day, I think, especially this time with Classic Who, I think it's like, just whack the prop there. you know,
it's on screen for like 30 seconds. No one's going to care, sort of thing.
Exactly. Yeah, and the focus of the frame, you know, how we're going to frame this shot is in the center of the screen, we're going to have the Doctor coming out of the TARDIS. Mm. That's what you need to focus on. As long as the door works and he can walk out of it, then, you know, whatever to the rest of it. So it's crazy. Like nowadays, you'd think like, bloody hell, if there was like a cracked bulb or a weird looking quirky thing, even if the little lamp on top of the TARDIS nowadays was off, you know, by a couple of degrees, you know, fandom are all over it. You know, so they can't afford to I see what you mean. It's weird that they go to all the effort to rebuild the prop and get it all looking nice, but then leave the old smash lamp on it. And
I'm pretty sure it was still smashed. Do you remember when Pertwee falls out of it in Spear from Space, his first story, and it looks like it's going to literally collapse as he falls out of it? It's in a really bad state. I think the light smashed then as well. I think it's the same smash light.
I had a crazy thought in the shower once that's made me look at the start of that story in a whole new way, and I can't unsee it now. For some reason, I thought, you know, when you just like, when you're walking to somewhere or you're in the shower and you're just alone with your thoughts and you have like craziness going on. For some reason, I thought that because the Doctor had regenerated, he'd been on a crazy bender, right? So he's absolutely smashed, like still like completely pissed the morning after. So now when he opens the door and he falls out the TARDIS, all I can see in my head now is not because he's, he's all over the place due to the regen, but because he's been on an absolute crazy bender,
he's smashed out of his face. And he smashed the TARDIS up on the way. He's exactly, like, you know, banging from pub to pub in the TARDIS.
So I can't unsee that now. So whenever, like, you've just mentioned it now, like, oh, that opening scene in Spearhead, so amazing, like how it looks and stuff. And I'm just like cracking up in the corner. Like, anyway, yes, the TARDIS prop. Thank God that it's so they improved it over the years, although it still looked a bit rickety, even like up to the McCoy era, it still looked a little bit wobbly. At least it starts to get a little bit more love, I guess.
Yeah.
Oh,
I think it was Davison as well said it absolutely stank inside that prop, which I can never get out my, a bit like you with that thought, I can never get out my head when they're coming out of it. It's, I think someone once posted a picture of the inside of it, you know, and it just looked really manky and mouldy and horrible. And I'm like, God, you can't believe, like you said, nowadays, they wouldn't stand for that, would they?
No.
You know, back then it's just get in there, you're only going to be in there 2 minutes, get in. In that box.
Oh, what a time, though. That's part of the charm, though, dude. That's
it
part
is.
Of the
totally is, yeah.
The stuff, isn't it? You know, when a lot of people who have never watched any Classic Who think, oh, I can't watch Classic Who because of all these things that we're talking about now, like the wobbly, that's like a common phrase, isn't it, within sort of a cult phrase, if you like, within Doctor Who. Like, it's always called wobbly sets. I think there's been podcasts called wobbly sets before or something, you know, blogs, whatever. The creature effects, you know, the stinky TARDIS and all these kind TARDIS, of weirdness going on. That's what makes it just amazing to watch. Anyway, this started off strong, you know, in terms of viewers. So people even came back in part three to see what the bloody hell was going on. So part one had 11 million viewers.
Wow, that's good, yeah.
Pretty good. Part two, 10.1. Mm. Part three, it must have ended on a really good cliffhanger, because part three, we're back up to 11 million.
Mm.
And then whatever happened in part three, people are like, no, rubbish. Oh. So part four and five, just under 9 million. And then part six finished on 7 million.
Oh, that is quite a decline, isn't it?
Yeah, so whatever happened, and I'm putting that down to what I mentioned right at the beginning. So parts four and five, it's really a struggle to get to the end of the 25 minutes, because you've just sat there and watched somebody drive through the countryside for 10 minutes. There's nothing, you can see what's going on in terms of how that's made up and contributes to the larger story. But in terms of what's going on in that moment, there's nothing really Doctor Who going on. You know what I mean? So still reasonable figures though, but you can tell that especially by part five, people are like, no, you've lost me.
Actually, the cliffhanger's a bit weak as well, aren't they, towards the end? I mean, the cliffhanger where he says, there's your traitor, Brigadier. Yeah. Of course, the Doctor's going to get arrested to be the traitor. Yeah, and I think, I can't remember what the cliffhanger was before that. I think there is a couple of really weak cliffhangers in this. And also, it tends to be the same cliffhanger of, the dinosaur's on the streets of London. You're just like, yeah, you've done that twice. You're doing it again.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, part two was pretty good. So at the end,
I was going to say, I think the first ones are good.
Yeah, they trigger off another time, Eddie, and the T-Rex appears right behind the Doctor.
Yeah.
At the end of part two. That's pretty cool. Part three, it's just Sarah waking up on the pretend spaceship.
That's it, yeah.
And then I think part four,
I think it's the dinosaur.
It's the dinosaur again with the Brig and the Doctor. Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
What do you think to the Doctor's cool dinosaur gun? Because I've always really liked that.
That's cool,
that,
isn't
that
it?
Contraption he makes.
Brilliant.
I like it. It's very dated, but very cool at the same time.
It is very cool, isn't it? And we've said this many times, but it's great when you see, especially Pertwee's Doctor, who was always a tinkerer. You know, he's always building something. There's always he's always got a workbench somewhere. And he's like soldering stuff together, and there's a bit of sellotape in there, I'm sure, and something else. But that thing that he comes up with is very cool. And it links him really nicely with the whole Yates sabotage thing, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
So, you know, we'll come on to Yates in a second. But yeah, that dinosaur gun thing, very, very cool. Very of its time.
It really suits Pertwee somehow. And I love that scene when he's getting very irascible, the Doctor, because he just wants to get on and be left alone, and the brig comes in with some author or something. And the Doctor lights up, doesn't he? He's like, oh, you're so-and-so, come in. And he starts chatting away, and the Briggs just rolls his eyes like, oh, God. You know, again, another, a really lovely little moment in the story, you know?
But do you know what? I love the Brig when he's like that with the Doctor.
He's brilliant in this one. He gets so many funny moments.
It's just amazing that even though he's witnessed the Doctor save the planet, and he knows all about the Doctor, he's still got that roll of the eyes like, oh, for God's sake, what are you doing now, Doctor? So you would have thought that, because they did the reverse of this, didn't they, in modern Doctor Who, like those early Tennant stories when UNIT's around and stuff like that. The Doctor's praised as this like general of UNIT, you know, they all salute him, and he's got, you know, he's almost like this kind of spiritual character to UNIT, you know. He's very much like, if this situation's big enough that they have to call the Doctor, then you will do exactly what he says, or what they say, sorry. And, you know, but back in the day with UNIT, they were very much like, oh, is this crazy bloody dude running around again?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Who is this crazy fool?
Yeah. And even like little things as well, when the Doctor's like, can you give me a lift or arrange for a Jeep? And Nick Courtney, the way he plays, it's like, oh, yes, fine. You know, so he begrudgingly picks up the phone. It's just hilarious, mate, that the banter between them two never goes away.
Yeah.
Even though the Brig knows how important the Doctor is, because he does fight his battles a little bit. So when the general turns up, Finch,
yeah.
And he demands that Sarah's escorted off the base or out of London, and the Doctor's, you know, placed back under arrest, all the rest of it. The Brig does go to bat for him a little bit. He does say, like, you know, he's the scientific advisor, I think, that they label him as, to UNIT. Even Yates, who's part of the sabotage, doesn't want any foul play coming to the Doctor. He's still like, you know, I'll do this and I'll do that, but I won't put the Doctor in harm's way, you know, and I won't do this. So they still kind of stick up for him in a way, but you can tell that Nick Courtney's playing it in such a way that he's doing it because he has to, not because he wants to. And it's hilarious sometimes, isn't it? It's that whole, what are you doing now, Doctor? Like, what are you bloody up to now? We've got dinosaurs running all over the place and you're tinkering with that bloody thing. That's what he's trying to get across. It's so good, mate. I absolutely love Pertwee and Nick Courtney together.
Absolutely.
The bants is off the chart, isn't it?
Great dynamic,
Brilliant, yeah. Right, let's talk about some characters to wrap this up then. So we got the usual UNIT crew. We've got those dudes who are just cannon fodder, essentially. They just run around firing off the machine guns, doing the usual, you know. I think Malcolm Hulk and Paddy Russell, very much with where it concerns UNIT, like the additional UNIT cast are just, they just wrapped up in this, they're the army guys.
Yeah.
So they don't come up with like anything scientific. They don't do anything with the Doctor. They just turn up with the guns, right?
That's it.
Never more is that apparent than the Daemons, when, you know, we have the famous line, you know, five rounds rapid, whatever it is.
Yeah.
So those dudes are just, they turn up with the guns. So the people who are actually doing the business in the story. So we've got, let's talk about the scientist dudes. So I think that is Professor Whittaker, played by someone who's goes on to have a very, very cool role in another story. So Peter Miles.
Yeah, I've forgotten he was in it.
Actually. Yeah, goes on to have a absolutely banging role, right, as Nida.
Nida.
So he's very cool in it. And then I think the other guy is a guy called, is it Butler, the other guy? So those two.
It's Butler, isn't it? Martin Jarvis. I couldn't think of the actor's name because I've seen him in quite a few things, I think. He looks very familiar, Martin Jarvis. Is he in Vengeance of Varos, maybe?
He is in
Planets. Is he?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, he is in Vengeance. Yeah, and he is in Vengeance of Varos as well. Just Googled it.
Oh, he is. Okay.
Yeah, I didn't know he was in the Web Planet, though. Gosh, is he one of the bird thing is
he's captain of the Monoptera.
The Monotra.
Yeah.
There you go. Wow, gosh.
Yes. Oh, he's the governor, isn't he, in Varus? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, so that, those two scientist guys, they're in cahoots with a couple of people from UNIT. And also a guy called Grover as well, played by Noel Johnson. So he's like a, another just sort of guy in a suit, essentially, in the story. So you've got Finch Yates from UNIT, Grover, who's, I think he's like a politician guy.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got these scientists. So those two are very good. Peter Miles and Martin Jarvis, those two are, not everything goes to plan for them because they're on constant alert, aren't they? Because they know that the doctor's sniffing around and, you know, how capable he is. And they don't believe it at first. He's, I think it's Yates that basically says, look, you know, the doctor's not to be underestimated. So, yeah, so those two are pretty cool.
Yeah, they are cool, yeah. And as I said, I forgot that Peter Miles was in it. And he does always give a sort of fairly... I think you kind of know what you're going to get with Peter Miles in a way, that he gives quite a solid performance. He's always very sort of cool underneath, isn't he? Just feel like he's got everything going on in his head. I was going to say monotone, but that sounds like a negative, and I don't mean it as negative. But the way he speaks and everything is very calm and calculated and has a slightly unnerving edge to it. So I think he suits that type of role that he often plays like this. So yes, he's good in it. And Martin Jarvis as well compliments him quite nicely. I think they're quite a good little duo as these two guys that are trying to, you know, make these experiments work. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, indeedy. Okay, what about Benson? Let's talk about Benson and Yates, the two dudes from UNIT. So Benson, John Levine, he's an easy one to give our thoughts on. He's just consistently good. And I'm glad that they wrote his character to be loyal to the Doctor, because not just in front of the camera, but John Levine has said many times, hasn't he, in interviews and stuff, that how much he absolutely loved working with John Pertwee.
He adored John
Pertwee. Yeah, and considered him as a mentor and, you know, someone to look up to as an actor and all that stuff. So it would have been really... It sounds strange to say, but I think if Benson had been written to be one of the conspirators as well, I think John Levine would have been a little bit upset at that.
Definitely, yeah. You know? He probably wouldn't have wanted to do it, I don't think.
Yeah, it sounds silly, but I think that's okay. So it's really cool, and then... The bit where he says, well, aren't you going to rough me up a little bit or something like that?
Yeah.
You
know? Yeah.
And how does he describe the martial art to him? He mispronounces it. I can't remember.
Yeah, he said, do one of your Venusian-y thingies on me or something.
Yeah, or something. Yeah, it's absolutely brilliant. So, and then when he turns around and his face, because he knows it's coming, is amazing. So, yeah, Benson has a pretty good one in this. And then Captain Yates. Actually, what do you think to Benson first?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he gets a few good moments, I think, in this. That's a nice scene between him and the Doctor, because you can see the friendship that's built up between the two characters as well as in real life. At this point, you know, it is John's last season, isn't it? It must be.
I think so.
So you can see that there's a friendship between the Doctor and Benton that's built up very nicely there. So that's a fun scene. He does get to have a bit of a ruckus at the end as well, which I would imagine John Levine loved getting to that sort of thing. When he takes Yates out at the end as well, he really throws poor old Richard Franklin across the room, doesn't he? You know, when he's got him on the filing cabinet, I'm like, blimmin' heck, he's going for it. So yes, he's quite good in it, I think. He doesn't get a lot of screen time, but I think he's fun in the scenes he's in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, true. Yep.
But what about Traitor Yates then?
Traitor Yates, so Richard Franklin.
Shocking.
So this is a result of, so that's the character Yates. He's essentially had his mind's a little bit messed up after the events of the Green Death. So before that, he was always just a solid UNIT guy, right? You know, but after the Green Death, he's like, I think he's just had a, in modern day times, I guess you would label it as PTSD. And because of that, he really buys into this story of, you know, let's press the reset button a little bit and go and really, he buys into this Operation Golden Age. And so because of that, he's kind of agreed to sabotage certain things and whatnot. But he draws the line at putting the Doctor in harm's way or anything like that.
Yeah.
And he's really quite angry at at Whittaker and Butler when they arrange for Sarah Jane to be eaten by the T-Rex and some other bits. And because I think the most that he gets into, right, is he sabotages the Doctor's, you know, makeshift dinosaur ray thing.
Oh, yeah, he puts that little sticker on the
front of it. Puts a little thing on it, isn't it? Yeah, and so, and at the end as well, it's a bit of a sad send-off for him because...
It is.
I think because of his many years of service and, you know, being a close ally to the Brig, the Brig's like, look, you know, to lessen the punishment, you know, you'll be put on extended sick leave, and then during that sick leave, you can quietly resign and you can go off quietly, sort of thing. Because I think initially he was going to be court-martialed and arrested and all that stuff. So yeah, the Brig is a little bit lenient on him in the end and stuff like that. But an interesting thing to write into the story where you've got this sort of secondary character within UNIT after the Brig in terms of popularity, I guess, and screen time, having a bit of a sabotage, bit of a mole thing going on. But I think he plays it well. He's got this good mix of determination mixed in with like regret on his face, it looks like, especially when Sarah Jane nearly gets killed and the Doctor nearly gets captured and killed and stuff. So yeah, it's an interesting one for Richard Franklin, but a good performance though.
Yeah, no, I think it's really nice that they give Yates this interesting character arc. I mean, because he's a good sort of foil. It's good when you get him and Benton together, but I think Benton often outshines Yates. I think Yates sort of sometimes disappears into the background as a character. So it's really nice that he finally gets, you know, a bit of meat on the bones in terms of a storyline. And it does really kind of suit his character as well. I love the fact that he's had this bit of a, you know, mind melt after the Green Death. It's really affected him and his mind's not quite in the right place. And he's sort of been brainwashed in a way to go along with this reset. He thinks it's like the right thing to do. So again, it's not like he's turned evil or gone bad. It's just that his mind's been affected and he really believes it's for the, you know, the right thing to do. I think it's a really interesting story. And I like the fact they did it with Yates rather than Benton. I think it definitely suits his character more. I think Richard Franklin plays it really, really well. Because you do believe that he wants to go along with this idea, but he's absolutely against anyone being harmed, which is, you know, so again, he's not gone bad. He's not turned bad, but he's given something to actually do. And yeah, it's interesting. I really like the storyline. I think it's unexpected as well. I mean, you sort of learn fairly early on that it's Yates that's the traitor, but when you do find that, I think at the time it would have been, no, Yates, surely not. You know, he seems like the sort of goody-goody, lovable Captain Yates. You know, you think, no, surely it's not. You might have even thought maybe he was going undercover to try and expose them and, you know, that it was all a ruse, but it's not. He actually is going along with it and has turned traitor, really. So, yeah, it's an interesting story, and I think Richard Franklin plays it really, really nicely. What happens to Yates after this? Because I can't remember. Does he pop up again or not? Because I thought he was in...
Yeah.
I thought he was in the last one, but I can't remember.
He does pop up again, I think.
Does he pop up in Planet Spiders? I can't remember.
He does, yeah. He pops up right at the end. I can't remember. Where does he... is he in the last one?
I honestly can't remember from this point onwards.
He is, he pops up in Planet of the Spiders, doesn't he? Because he's...
I think so.
There's like a non-unit guy. Is that right? He's in, or is he part of UNIT?
I honestly can't remember, mate. I'd like to think we see Mike again, like there's some sort of redemption. But I'll be honest with you, I can't remember what happens to his character after this. But it's nice he gets an interesting story, I think, because Yates has been in the sort of background of the Pertwee era quite a lot, and he gets his odd moments, but never anything as meaty as this. So I think it's really cool. Yeah, it's a good story. Right.
Yeah, so post-UNIT, after he's left UNIT, he's still going through his mind is still not right, basically. So he enlists in this Buddhist meditation center to try and sort of find calm and solace and stuff like that. And that's when he uncovers the weirdness going on.
Yes, of course. Yes. Yeah.
And he reports that to Sarah Jane.
Yeah, so he does redeem himself a little bit.
He does a little bit. And if I remember, Sarah's a little bit like, I remember your shenanigans from when just before you were you left unit. So she's like, but I think in the end they kind of work things out and she considers him like a decent ally and stuff. But yeah, he does pop back up, mate. Yeah, but just not as unit.
Of course, because Sarah wouldn't trust him. She hasn't known him as long. So if it was Joe Grant, she would probably be more inclined to sort of believe what he says, you know, but Sarah wouldn't because she hasn't known him as long, I guess.
True.
Yeah, yes. Interesting.
Yeah. Okay, we've spoken about Nick Courtney then as the
brilliant
brig.
As always.
Yeah, another good performance in this one. You can also see that he's fighting back so much to not bite back at Finch.
Yeah. So he wants to give Finch a good... a bunch of fives, I reckon.
He does, yeah. There's some really good scenes where Finch is a sort of, you know, storms in, demands the doctor's arrested.
Yeah.
And the brig, he does follow orders, to give him his credit. You know, Nick Courtney plays that very well. But you can just tell that the look on his face is like, if the circumstance were different, I'd have let you have it by now.
Definitely, yeah.
So John Bennett then as General Finch, your typical army general character that they've cast for this one, and they've made him look. But he was also a little bit sly as well with the way he played it, which is very good. John Bennett. There's a scene where Sarah Jane's all smiley with him, like, "Oh, well, you'd be able to give me a pass, wouldn't you?" And all that lot. And he's like, to get her out of the way, he sort of gets a notebook out, and then as she walks out, he's almost turns to camera, but not quite, and he's got this sly little grin on his face, and then we obviously find out he's part of the project later on, and holds Sarah at gunpoint and all that lot. So he was a cool character, but not very likable. So you wouldn't want to see him in many unit stories.
No, I agree. I think he's great in this story. I think John Bennett's good casting. He looks kind of shifty. I couldn't remember if when I started watching this, I was thinking, yeah, is it like, is that to fool us? Is he supposed to look like the obvious villain, but turns out not to be? I couldn't remember, but then he actually turns out to be part of it. But yes, it's a nice performance from him. I think he's quite sort of shifty, but I think he could only work in a certain amount of stories. So I think he's right that he's, you know, in this one and we don't really see him again.
Yeah, true. Yeah,
he's got a little bit of a look about of the master about him as well. I wonder if back in the day people might have thought he was going to turn out to, you know, rip his face off and have like, it's the master all along again. But yeah, he's got that sort of shifty look about him.
Very shifty.
Yeah. But he's good. Yeah.
Liz Sladen then, Sarah Jane. She has a good one in this one. I think the last, when we were talking about the last story we reviewed her in, which was The Seeds of Doom last week, obviously, I commented that although she's fantastic, obviously, Liz Sladen, she didn't really have a great deal to do apart from a few standout scenes. She didn't really have a lot to do, but I think in this one they really stepped up her involvement because she's off doing her own thing quite a lot. She's still got that journalistic drive. You know, she even says to the brig, I think, she's like, "He's right if I go and get my camera and take a bunch of photos because, you know, I'm still a journalist and all that stuff." And then the whole capture and almost getting eaten by the dinosaur and going onto the fake spaceship and then back to unit and all that. She has a much more... there's a lot more substance to her in this story versus The Seeds of Doom, I think. And I think she had a really good story, but just more than anything, she's just has, another way to put it, she just has more substance as a character, and Liz Sladen's brilliant at playing that substance. So yeah, I much prefer her in this than last week's.
Yes. She definitely gets more to do. I think she's great in it actually. I was surprised in watching it is how little screen time there is with her and the Doctor together. They're very much split off and doing their own thing. And I don't know what it is, but I never really... there's something about the Third Doctor and Sarah Jane that I don't feel much connection between the two characters somehow. They never have the same dynamic. Maybe it's because I just associate her so much with Tom's Doctor and you can just feel that the two of them got on, but I never feel quite the same connection between Sarah Jane and the Third Doctor, although I like them together and they do have nice moments. I don't know, there's always something slightly missing. So I think it works better in this story when they're apart and they're doing their own thing, and she definitely takes control and does her own thing. And I think she's really good in it and gets some really great, great moments. It's interesting. I didn't know until I read the production notes on this story that April Walker was actually cast. The actress April Walker was cast as Sarah Jane. And John Pertwee said no. He's like, no, 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 I can't have her. So April Walker, the name didn't mean anything to me, but when I Googled her, she was in an episode of Fawlty Towers. She played, oh gosh, Jean somebody. I'm trying to think of the episode now. So as soon as I saw her picture, I knew her. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh yes, I know that actress. And I was trying to picture what she would have been like as Sarah Jane. But yeah, she was not happy, April Walker, as you can imagine. Her contract was signed. She had been offered the part. She was, you know, ready to go when John Pertwee said, no, she's not right, because he wasn't consulted about the casting. And so they recast her, Sarah Jane, with Liz Sladen. And April Walker was not happy about this. You know, she said she had to work with John Pertwee a few years later. And she said, you know, we got on fine, but I said to him, I'll never forgive you. And you can understand that, because she probably thought that would have been the making of it, you know. Doctor Who companion, that would have been what she was known for. Whereas if I say the name April Walker, I would imagine a lot of people listening to this podcast are going, who? You know, you might know her face if you Google it and think, oh, I've seen her in little bits here and there. But yeah, I didn't realise that. I never realised that someone was actually contracted and cast and ready to go as Sarah Jane and then vetoed by John Pertwee. Would that happen now? Can you imagine, like, I don't know, Jodie Whittaker turning around and saying, no, 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 I'm not having Bradley Walsh. No, 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 you need to find a different actor. He's not right for the part. I don't know that it would happen now, but John Pertwee was... had that much say back in the day.
Yeah, not so much in TV. It happens in films now and then still, like especially big people with like lots of power, like someone like Tom Cruise would have a lot of influence over in TV that's crazy, like for someone to have their contract signed and everything and then jump, because you can completely see why she would be like the way, like they got on fine, but she's like, not going to forgive you for that one, mate.
I mean, bloody I can't hell. Really imagine. It's interesting to think what she might have been like as Sarah Jane, because Liz Sladen just absolutely is Sarah Jane, isn't she? We can't imagine anyone else being in that role. So maybe Pertwee was right, because it wasn't a personal thing. He just said, she's not right for the role. She's tall, blonde. You know, I need somebody. I think basically what he's saying is, I need somebody I can sort of... take under my wing, and right. April Walker's not that person. She's too strong. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it was something like that he didn't want her. But yeah, Liz Sladen, you just can't imagine anyone else being Sarah Jane. And she is very good in the story. I love the bit where she's on the spaceship and she really gets to be strong and be like, when she walks out the airlock and she's just like, see, you know, she's so gutsy, isn't she? Like, mm-hmm. she could have been sucked into space. She could have been got it all wrong, you know, but Sarah Jane's just like, goes for it. I love that about her.
Yeah, she's very cool.
Yeah.
What about John Pertwee then? The man himself. Give me your thoughts while I think about this.
Okay, I think Pertwee's very good in it. I think he's doing all the action stuff. I don't know if it's just because I know that it's his last season that I feel like he looks a little bit tired at times. I feel like he may be struggling with the action scenes and the fights and stuff. Not struggling with them, but... he's definitely more relaxed in the role than if I think of him in Inferno, when he's racing around the screen, you know, like a madman. You can tell that it's a few years later and quite naturally he's aged and he just feels a little bit more, I wouldn't say subdued, but different. There's definitely a difference in his performance in this season. But that's not to say it in a bad way. I still think he's great in it. I think he does the humor well. He does do the action well. I love all the tinkering, making gadgets and stuff. And I absolutely loved it when he flipped the switch at the end and the guy shouted, he's reversed the polarity. I was like, oh my gosh. They got it in there. They got the line in there. Yeah, I mean, I still think he's wonderful in it. You know, the Whomobile racing around in that. And he's got this look about him, you know, this sort of slightly haggard look, you know. Mm-hmm. The hair's got bigger, the face has got more wrinkly, but it's still, yeah, I was gonna say grandfatherly, that's not what I mean at all. There is something about him, you know, it's just, you feel like a warmth towards his doctor very much. But I think you can sort of tell it's getting to the end of his run a little bit somehow. In that, I do love the end scene. Absolutely love the end scene with him and Sarah, because I do feel like moments like that are missing when he's like trying to coax her into another adventure and she's like, no, no, no. And he's like, come on, come on. You know, that was nice. But yeah, great scenes with him in the brig. But yeah, overall strong, mate. I think strong. Yeah, strong performance from John.
Yeah, the same. A strong performance. I just wanted to get your thoughts, and because I wanted to say the same thing, and I think you nailed it, where he's just looking a little bit tired versus some of the previous seasons as him as a doctor. Still very cool, still very strong. But you just get the feeling that he's not quite as energetic in some things. But that's, like you said, he's aged a little bit since he first did it, by a few years. So yeah, and he was knocking on a little bit at this point. What age was he when he finished doing Doctor Who? He must have been in his...
I don't know, actually, because I often think John Pertwee is one of those actors that looked old all the time. He just looked like probably older than he was because of the hair and everything. But I don't know how old he was, to be honest.
But so he's very cool in it still, very charming. And, you know, he's got that. We often compare him to almost a bit James Bondy at times in some of his stories. And he's got that stuff going on. So, yeah, I really liked him in this. Very cool. Just a little bit. A little bit laboured, a bit tired in some places, I guess, is the best way to put it.
Yeah, it comes to us all. You know, it's just one of those things, isn't it? You just can't help but notice that he's obviously aged, you know, since other stories. If you think about him in the Sea Devils, when he's like jumping out across army barracks and stuff. And in this, he's still doing all the action. But yeah, it's just part of life. He definitely looks a bit older. Yeah.
Indeedy. Yes. It's bugging me now. I didn't know that.
What, his age?
His age when he left.
Because he was a Gummidge after this, didn't he?
He did, yeah. Which is crazy to think about because...
Yeah, I know, yeah.
In Wurzel Gummidge, he's mega animated and up for it all over the place.
Mm. Well, maybe it was that old Doctor Who schedule getting to him, mate, which seems to get to a lot of actors. It's grueling, I think, Doctor Who. It's a lot going on, isn't there, in Doctor Who?
Yeah, so I think he was around about 50 when he left Doctor. I can't remember exactly. I did know this ages ago, but he was either 50 when he started doing Doctor Who or round about 50 when he finished, one of the two.
Okay, someone out there will know and let us know, I'm sure.
Yeah, anyway. Yeah. Anything else on your notes, Bud, before we put scores down?
No, the only two things I've got left on my notes are that it's whenever I put on an episode of Pertwee, I always expect to see the red graphics at the intro. And when we get the star tunnel effect, it always takes me by surprise and I love it. I absolutely love it.
It's amazing.
It's one of my favourite intros, that the liney tunnel effect that then goes into the tunnel effect that they use for Tom Baker's Doctor. Love that intro, so that's always good. And Dudley's music, I thought, was fairly standard. Is it Dudley? I assumed it was Dudley. I don't know. Didn't check.
Is it
Dudley,
mate.
Simpson?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, his music, fairly standard. Still good. Nothing stand out, except for the end. That end scene I talked about where the Doctor's trying to Sarah into silence. There was a beautiful, almost psychedelic piece of music that seems to drift in from nowhere, which I just thought was beautiful. A little hats off to Dudley for throwing that in at the end.
Indeedy, yes. And anyone that's not subscribed to Adam's YouTube channel, The Geek's Handbag, if you go and do that, or you might remember that Adam did a video a few years back now where he had said he'd let us know what his favourite Doctor Who intro is, and he's standing in front of a TV and he shows off this very intro.
God, I don't even remember doing that.
Yeah, you did, yeah.
What video is that?
Can't remember, it was years ago now, but...
Wow.
Yeah. And you played that intro and you're like, this is my favourite, and it's the star tunnel.
It's probably a Q&A video. God, you got a good memory, that's from years ago. But yes, it is. It is my favourite intro, I love it.
It's very cool, yeah. Okay, scores and adores. I think it's you to go first, Bud. What you got?
Yeah, I think I'm going to be a bit higher than you this week. I'm going to give this an 8 out of 10. I really enjoyed it.
An 8. Very nice.
An 8, yeah. Not perfect, but yeah, 8 out of 10. Very enjoyable.
Yeah, nice one, dude. I'm a little bit lower. I'm going to give this a 7.
A 7. Okay, fair enough.
Yeah. I think it's... I think it's a very cool watch. And, I think there are many... Actually, many. Is that the right word? there's a few Pertwee stories which are way better.
Fair enough.
Than this. So it's a decent enough watch, but yeah, not amazing. Okay, so an 8 from him, a 7 from me. What did our awesome listeners think? Over on Twitter, Will Sanger said, the dinosaurs are shockingly bad, but you've got a really good story. The script from Malcolm Hulk is very good, examining the impact humanity had on the planet with the waste that comes with pollution, etc. The villains, very relatable motives, only with warped mindsets. Yes.
Yes.
Chippy T says, intriguing this one. Terrible effects, but a decent story. Betrayal at the highest level and an attempt to dupe people into believing in a future utopian society. Fun action scenes and a nice threat level, a 6.5.
Cool, okay.
Owen, Doctor Who Home says, watched this last week. One of my faves. A bit of a last hurrah for UNIT with Pertwee. The dinosaurs are naff, but there's lots of charm that comes with the dodgy puppets. The end is quite sad when the brig talks about Yates' extended leave. A nice character twist. 9 out of 10.
A 9?
A 9, yeah. Edward Galuli, a good story that manages to rise above the dinosaurs. It goes in directions you really wouldn't expect, especially with the people, quote-unquote, in space. And Edward gives it a 7.5.
Okay.
Lucy McCall says, I love Invasion Dinosaurs. There are excellent characters, really well played, from the regulars to the other characters. Yates' moral dilemma and how he tries to justify his actions himself and others are well played by Richard Franklin. And the loyalty of Benton, in contrast, is touching. And I cheered when he and the brig faced down Finch and when he punched him or was preparing to. I love that Sarah has her own plot and is brave, clever and resourceful. The villains are convincingly nasty, from the deluded, idealistic Charles Grover to the frankly terrifying Carmen Silvera as Ruth.
Oh, yes, we forgot about her, didn't we?
Yeah, she's the old bird on the fake spaceship.
You stupid woman. It's from a lower low.
Yeah. And she says, Lucy goes on to say, oh, and I don't care that the dinosaurs look like they do. The real threat are from the humans.
Absolutely.
Yes, very nice. Thank you very much, Lucy, and everyone else over on the Twitter. On Facebook, we had Martin Arnold. Says, no, Mike, no. Just throw some soup at a painting like the rest of us. Bloody hippies sending toy dinosaurs through time to destroy London. They've gone too far. Some people just spoil it for others. great stuff. 65 million years out of 10. Jurassic Park wishes it could do CGI like this.
It does.
I think that's a 6.5 he's saying there.
Okay.
Yep. Lewis Palmer, one of my very fave Pertwee adventures. Great fun with a brilliantly written script and thoughtful themes that are still very relevant to this day. Look past the dino boys and you'll have a blast. 8 out of 10.
Hey, cheers.
Toby Coleman says, well, the storyline is good. However, it is about two episodes too long and Jurassic Park it is not. The concept is a great one that rings true nearly 50 years later. The cast are very good, even though you can't really trust any of them. 6.5 wobbly inflatable dinosaurs. Nick Gill, how are you, my good friend? Nick says, well, this is an interesting one. A much maligned story that is mainly due to the incredibly poor effects. No point in glossing over them. They are terrible, even for 70s TV sci-fi standards. But the story is okay, and Pertwee keeps the pace going nicely. A main plot point of the great and the good being held prisoner in the bunker whilst being lied to is lifted straight from The Enemy of the World, but that doesn't really matter too much. I give it a rewatch where I can, as I always laugh when the soldiers just judder their guns up and down to simulate gunfire, where in previous stories and future stories, blank rounds were used. Never sure why they tried this. Obviously didn't work, but a 7 out of 10.
Cool.
Yes.
That's interesting about The Enemy of the World, yeah.
Yeah. Sean Mundy, I rewatched this because you are reviewing it. My biggest memory was obviously the bad looking dinosaurs, which, yes, they do look bad, but it's definitely a very good story that unfortunately couldn't be executed with the 70s budget. 7 out of 10. Charlie Turner, great story this, but the dinosaurs in this one are so adorably atrocious more than anything. Here's hoping that when season 11 gets released in the collection, the Blu-ray gives us an option for more convincing CG ones and better colorization for episode one, even though I can see that they at least tried. 9 out of 10 from Charlie.
Okay.
Would you want to see a version of this with CG dinosaurs, dude? More up-to-date looking dinos?
I would, actually, which I'm not normally a fan of when they do new effects, because I think they often look dated before, you know, as dated as the other one. So I'm not normally a fan of when they update them. I'm normally quite happy to settle for what we had back in the day, because, like you've said many times, it has a charm to it. But this is a rare exception where I feel like they are so bad that I feel like it would be nice if they did updated effects for this one, yeah.
Hmm, okay. Because the BBC have done a ton of CG dinosaurs over the years with their Walking with Dinosaurs series and everything. So they've got
Well, they could just edit some of that in. No one will know. Just
plonk some of that in. Yeah. Thank you very much, Charlie. And lastly, Aaron Ball says, an underrated watch. It does drag, I won't lie, in areas, but Yates has a great story in this. The cast are on great, per usual. And the model dinosaurs, well, it's just like the charm of Classic Who. 7.5 dinosaurs out of 10. Cheers, guys.
Cool.
Righty-o. Thank you very much. I think the average on there is about a 7, I think, dude.
Yeah, I would have said that. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. That was Invasion of the Dinosaurs. Next week, what have we got, dude?
Well, I don't know when we last saw this Doctor. Feels like ages ago. So we're going to revisit a fifth Doctor story, Frontios.
Frontios, right.
Frontios, yes.
Okay. Yeah, we haven't watched any Davidson in ages, have we?
I feel like we haven't seen him in years. What the hell was the last Davidson story we did, if you can remember?
I can have a very quick look through. Let's have a look. The last one was Enlightenment, which was back in May of last year.
Nearly a year ago.
That was the last time we saw any Davidson. Sorry, Mr. Davidson.
So sorry.
Anyway, yeah, so Frontios next week.
Yeah.
So get that watched, obviously, because we'll be asking for your reviews and everything on that next week. So, cool. All right, let's wrap there, dude, then, for episode 373.
All righty.
Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of The Big Blue Box. That was 373. Next week for 374, as Adam said, we are reviewing the fifth Doctor story, Frontios. So get your DVDs out or your BritBox fired up and give that a watch, as we'll be asking for your thoughts and your scores as always. In the meantime, make sure you are following or subscribing to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. That way you won't miss an ep when they land every Friday. And you can listen for free on the website over at bigblueboxpodcast.co.uk. We're on the socials too. Find links on the website or do a search for us. We're on Instagram, Twitter and Facebook and Mastodon. Come and link up with us over there. We chat Doctor Who throughout the week and we have a very cool free Discord server. So you can hop in there. We've got a very cool community of Who fans that we've built up over the last year or two on Discord. It's an active server as well. People chatting there regularly, so hop in and chat Who over there. Also, don't forget to remember to check out my co-host channel on YouTube. Go and check out that video I was talking about where he does a little Q&A and tells you his favourite intro and loads of other cool stuff. It's called The Geek's Handbag.
The Geek's Handbag, yes. Go and check out my YouTube channel, also on the socials, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
Instagramage. And, hold on.
TikTok,
he's on it.
I've got one video on there.
I've seen it, mate. It's very nice. Very nice.
Finally joined the talk.
Indeed. So go and follow Adam. Go and do all the things. Give him a bit of a stalk. Chat Doctor Who all us throughout the week. It's all good. Right, until next week for 374, my name's Gary.
My name's Adam.
And remember,